Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank the organizing committee for inviting me to this important day. My name is Ariane Morelli. I'm an associate professor at McGill University. I did my training in a variety of places, including McGill University, University of Montreal, UCLA, and Harvard. I founded and direct the Maud Unit, named after Maud Abbott, who I will speak about today. This is one of the largest adult congenital heart disease programs in Canada and arguably in the world. We train people from all over the world. We have a very robust research program. We train international fellows and undergraduate and graduate students. We've published a large number of important papers, and we've also published a textbook of congenital heart disease. And so it's this perspective and this experience that I bring today. The title of my lecture is Out of the Blue and Into the Pink, A Story of Women in 20th Century Medicine. So in the next 15 or so minutes, I will talk a little bit about relevant elements, or at least elements that have interested me in the backdrop for understanding how the two women I'm going to talk about today have emerged. So a backdrop for 100 years of women in medicine. And then we'll take a look at the two women I'm talking about and their life through their lens, the lens of Maud Abbott and Ellen Taussig, both of whom have made seminal contributions to the new knowledge that has been acquired over the last century, specifically with regard to congenital heart disease, or babies who were born as blue babies and were not able to really survive until more recently. And lastly, I'll close with a couple of personal remarks on women in academic medicine and some reflections at this particular crossroad. Before talking about the last 100 or 150 years or so, I just want to pay homage to Elena Lucrezia Cornaro Piscopia, who is in fact the first prima donna laureata nel mondo, which is the first laureate of the world. This is a picture that I had an opportunity to take on a visit to Padua, Italy. I believe it was in 2006. And was able to show my daughter the story and tell her the story of this woman who actually had come from aristocracy and was in fact the first woman to graduate with a degree in philosophy, we think pretty much worldwide. So the backdrop, what was going on in the early 1900s? The early 1900s was marked by a lot of changes in art and in art history. Picasso's contributions were huge in helping us to look at things in a completely different way. This painting is one of my favorite. It's called The Tragedy. It was done in 1903, and it marks the beginning of his blue period, which really corresponds to a blue period for us in congenital heart disease. Children who are born with malformed hearts are blue at birth. They have a condition called cyanosis, and so we refer to them as blue babies. I particularly like this painting because it shows a child, it shows a father, it shows a mother, and really we are often in a situation where we're dealing with an entire family. So a blue baby with a malformed heart was considered beyond the reach of quotes-unquote surgical aid, and this is something that was written by Ellen Taussig early on. In another area, we, at the turn of the century, were just beginning to understand the impact of what was called the Second Industrial Revolution, or the technological revolution, which of course has continued to have a huge impact on what we've been doing in the last 100 years in medicine. So the latter half of the 19th century until World War I, and you can see what the Industrial Revolution was conveyed here actually in a woman's magazine. The impact of industrialization was marked. Early women physicians, like social feminists, were instinctive critics of the dehumanization inherent in industrialization. And this led to a century of women really focusing on what we call the more humane or the more nurturing aspects of medicine, often going into pediatric specialties and often going into specialties which other people did not want to go into. On the other hand, with this industrial revolution and the technological revolution came a huge number of tools which allowed us to be able to image the human body for the first time. This is the early Crookes tube apparatus in the late 1800s, which really gave rise to X-rays. This is Marie Curie, who wanted to push around this radiography machine to be able to treat wounded soldiers in World War I. And this is a picture taken from one of Ellen Taussig's original articles using chest X-rays as really the basis for her clinical observations, which I will describe, and her seminal contributions to the knowledge which we use today. On a different front, we've heard a lot about activism in Quebec, but internationally, women were starting to acquire the right to vote. Historically, this is a very interesting, makes for very interesting reading, how it happened in different dates in different countries. But this is a picture of the International Women's Suffrage Alliance in 1904. The idea of suffrage for women originated with John Stuart Mill, who was a British philosopher, and this actual picture is of American women and British women. American women originally took their inspiration from British women. In education, the Flexner Report was published in 1910. This was a seminal report looking at medical schools in Canada and the United States. There were 8 at the time in Canada and 147 in the United States. It's very interesting to note that at the time, medical education was largely governed by private funds and was seen as an opportunity to actually be able to make money. After the publication of the Flexner Report, a lot of that changed, and we started to think about medical education with the notion of formal analytical reasoning and the kind of thinking that was integral to natural science. So just at the turn of the century, we were starting to think differently about medical education and academic medicine. So this backdrop in technology, art, and medical education and women's rights really provides the stage by which these two women emerge and are two interesting examples of a century of new discovery in heart disease and for women in medicine. Maud Abbott was born in 1869 and lived to 1940, so she didn't live as long a life as Ellen Taussig, who was born in 1898. And lived to 1986. So born just on the cusp of the 19th century and really made their contributions in the early part of the 20th and mid part of the 20th century. You see here Ellen Taussig holding a stethoscope, a key tool for people who are cardiologists. It's notable that she became deaf throughout her life, actually very deaf at a young age, but she was still able to persist and practice. She's caring for a child here, very naturally turned to the kind of disease that other people were not necessarily as interested in. You see here Maud Abbott, whose story at McGill is a very interesting one from the moment she graduated and then went to medical school. So two women, two backgrounds. Fascinating stories. Maud Abbott, born in 1869 in St. Andrews, Quebec. Father was a minister accused of murder. He fled to the United States. Her mother died of TB. She was raised by a maternal grandmother. She was an undergraduate at McGill until 1890. But at that time, although according to the Flexner Report, most schools were accepted both sexes. McGill did not accept any women in medicine. So she went to Bishop's College, where she was accepted, and graduated from there in 1894. In 1898, she was given a position as an assistant curator of McGill's Museum of Pathology Specimens, a job that nobody else wanted. She was given that job. She took that job, and as you'll see, she did made extraordinary contributions with that opportunity. She also traveled to the United States to meet the illustrious Osler, who had been a fellow here. Ellen Taussig, born in 1898, so just over 15 years later, in Boston. Her father was a professor of economics at Harvard. Her mother also died of TB, and so she was largely raised by her father. She was an undergraduate at Berkeley until 1921, and even though her father was an illustrious professor of economics at Harvard, she was not admitted to medical school at Harvard because they were not admitting women. She went to John Hopkins University, where she graduated in 1927. John Hopkins was probably one of the first universities to admit women in medicine. And then in 1928, she was not able to obtain an internship anywhere. So somebody said to her, well, you can put yourself at the heart station, which was like saying doing a sort of cardiology rotation. And so she did, and she stayed there for a couple of years and completed a pediatric residency. And then again, because nobody else was interested, she was charged with the first pediatric cardiology clinic at Hopkins. This is a picture of McGill's Museum of Pathology. In this museum, there are extraordinary specimens that Maud Abbott restored and named, and these specimens provided the basis for the 1936 publication of the Atlas of Congenital Heart Disease. This was the first book on congenital heart disease ever. It was the first book to catalog these conditions, and it really provided the basis for an understanding of these lesions, which had to date been unavailable. It was left to Maud Abbott, fired by a spark, to make the subject of congenital heart disease one of such general and widespread interest. She has been the most important of the pioneers in establishing congenital heart disease as a living part of clinical medicine. This was written by Paul Dudley White, who actually has written the foreword to her book. It was particularly relevant to me because during my time on faculty at Harvard, this was actually right at the entrance of the building where my office was. This is a picture of the heart specialist, which is a fictional account of Maud Abbott's life, but Claire Rothman Holden is an extraordinary Canadian author who tells a very great story of Maud Abbott's life, and I strongly recommend this book. Now, Ellen Taussig's observation. Here is a picture of the heart. You see here the blue part of the heart and the red part of the heart with blue blood and red blood. And Ellen Taussig had used x-rays to deduce that she had noticed that children who had a patent ductus arteriosus, or a patent communication between the red circulation and the blue circulation, were actually living longer when they were born with congenital heart disease. And so in her paper of 1945, she says, furthermore, one of us, because she wrote the paper with somebody else, HBT herself, has seen several infants where cyanosis, or bluish discoloration of the skin because of lack of oxygenation in the blood, was not apparent until the ductus arteriosus was closed. So she imagined an operation where one would construct a conduit or a communication between the two circulations when the ductus arteriosus was closed. And she went around to several universities and several people, including Dr. Gross, who was one of the leading authorities in surgery at the time, and proposed her ideas and was completely laughed out of the water. She finally collaborated with Dr. Blaylock at Hopkins, who had the help of an assistant, who was a black assistant, a Negro assistant, and who in fact did most of this work, even though Dr. Blaylock took the credit. So the work was done by the assistant. The idea came from Ellen Taussig. Dr. Blaylock got a lot of the credit. And in a letter which she actually sent to the vice president of medical affairs at Stanford, which was given to me by my mentor, Dr. Perloff, it was written in 1966, she says of this work, in June of 1945, after Dr. Blaylock and I had done our first blue baby work, and it was acknowledged as a milestone, and basically they all knew that the idea was mine, although the surgical success was Dr. Blaylock's. He, of course, was professor of surgery. I was not even promoted from being an assistant to an associate professor. Two women, two backgrounds, but same values. Passion, resilience, patience, flexibility, innovation, and imagination. And I would submit to you that those values are the values that drive us today, probably not just women, but also men. We do it differently, and we'll hear about that more this afternoon, and I'll give you some personal thoughts on that. But these are the values that drove both these women, very different backgrounds, two different countries, and which drove them to make huge contributions in this field. So the impact of their knowledge Kids, broken hearts, no longer fatal. This was an article which was published in the Gazette when we released one of our first papers really showing the change in epidemiology of congenital heart disease for the first time in the general population. And it really depicts in layman terms the incredibly successful impact of everything that followed from the work of these two women in seeing a first and a new generation of adults who would survive with congenital heart disease. This is a picture of Mackenzie Klein, who is a professional champion golfer. She was born with a very serious heart defect, had extensive surgery, and competes to this day and says, if I could walk, I would, but I need the carts to compete. She actually competes, but she competes wearing oxygen. A young lady, the result of this extraordinary journey, which started with these two women, and who fights it her own way, but fights it nonetheless. This is a picture of one of our patients from the MOD unit. Basically, he was interviewed and talked about his own personal journey, and it was the story was titled One of the Great Success Stories of 20th Century Medicine. Firsts in congenital heart disease across the century. There were many firsts. This is a very interesting field which was pioneered by women. 1936, Maud Abbott's first atlas. 1933, Ellen Taussig's first blue baby operation. And I say 1933 instead of 1945 because when you go back and you read her original manuscripts, she describes three cases. The first case she performed in 1933 in a 9-year-old. 1973, Roberta Williams, who I had the privilege of training with at UCLA, first cardiac ultrasound correlates of congenital heart disease. If you want to take care of patients, you actually have to be able to see their organs. Cardiac ultrasound has become a very important part of what we do, and Roberta Williams was the first to publish a book on using cardiac ultrasound in congenital heart disease. 1974, Jane Somerville, the first grown-up congenital heart disease center in Europe. And I took out of the blue and into the pink from one of her lectures, which I heard in the 90s, and she had said, out of the blue and into the pink, is it so rosy for the cardiologists? But I like to think of it a little bit differently. 1993, the first graduate of the first adult congenital heart disease center in the United States. This led to the publication of a book on congenital heart disease clinical recognition, which is the most widely sold book worldwide. 2001, Carol Warnes, the first woman to co-author the first set of American guidelines for adults with congenital heart disease, whom I've had the privilege of knowing. She trained with Jane Somerville, and she is now at Mayo Clinic. I like to think of context. I like to think of tipping points. I like to think of backdrops. For me, this was a very important, not me personally, but historically when I look back, this was a very important tipping point. I think that we talked yesterday, we heard Professor Rositer talk about the changes that occurred in the 70s, and we're going to hear more about that today. But this was the cover of Time magazine in 1967. The birth control pill was born and basically started to give women a choice. And to me, this remains the idea that most strongly resonates in my own career, the idea of a choice. This is taken from an excellent book called Changing the Culture of Academic Medicine by Linda Pololi, who's written a number of very interesting articles on medical education. And I'm just going to read it. It talks about the dual race. There seems to have been a race between our becoming professors or doctors and our challenging the world for it to be morally acceptable for us to occupy such positions. This was not, of course, a race we could win. We were doomed to succeed more quickly than we could change the world. The moral question we now face turns on acceptable, politically accountable compromise. Can we live the positions we occupy differently enough? We do live them differently. Can we live them differently enough? And Dr. Newkirk is going to talk about that this afternoon. This is a picture of Carol Greeter, who was the Nobel Prize laureate in 2009 for work that she did in science. And to my knowledge, this is the only picture of a Nobel Prize laureate, of a winner of a Nobel Prize laureate, taken with her children. This is a picture of myself and my two children, and this is the title of a lecture and the slide that I use in a lecture, which I, when I talk about differences between the sexes in cardiology care. And I say sex differences, do they matter? I think anybody who's had a boy and a girl knows that sex differences matter tremendously. And I leave you with my own thoughts on our dual mission. Women incubate the intellect of the future because we teach not only our daughters, but also our sons. Thus, from one generation to the next, we shape the moral fiber of the societies we live in. We are destined to choose, or not, to embrace both of these missions. Thank you very much.